The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
It's like nothing we've seen since the Second World War.
The NHS and the military are turning the giant XL conference centre in the London Docklands into a hospital.
The number of cases in New York is doubling every 3 days.
We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war. And we're fighting an invisible enemy. Think of that.
But it's not a war. It's a virus. And whole societies have shut down.
Within just a few seconds, the Dow down a whopping 9.71%.
All reason flies by the wayside. The most intelligent people are doing the most bizarre things.
I just come in from the supermarket and it's pretty much total chaos. People just buying to buy.
What's really going on? Is it just a virus? Or, for want of a better word, a revolution?
There's an ancient Chinese expression that says, may you live in interesting times.
Life will go on, but not necessarily as we've lived it before. Welcome to Coronavirus Lockdown. Today, Zoe and Luke are joined by the economist James Meadway to find out whether capitalism can survive this existential crisis. Strap in.
James, welcome to the show.
Hey, James.
Hey, James.
A whole new format for us, in isolation podcast recording.
Yeah, it's quite weird, isn't it? Over the last few days, we're starting to get this glimpse on the television news into everybody's front rooms. It's been a little side effect of the coronavirus crisis.
So a really nice, easy question to start with. Can you explain what capitalism is, James, and what happens to capitalism when things stop? So you stop going to work, stop going to restaurants, stop doing all the things that capitalism needs for us to reproduce ourselves on this planet. That's got to be really bad for the system, right?
Well, yes, it is. And that's the unusual feature about capitalism, which is really a way of describing the economy and society that we all now live in. I mean, this is something right the way across the globe. And it really, it's been around, let's say, in its sort of industrial form with factories, with lots and lots of production taking place for the last sort of 200 years or so. And the critical point to guess about it is that this is a very, very competitive system. So it's lots and lots of individual or group together capitalists, people who own different ways of producing wealth, all in competition with each other in different forms. That could be like we are used to in this country, a sort of private capitalism where you have different companies that compete with each other. Or you can start to have, and we see this increasingly across the world, versions of a kind of state capitalism where you have a government that owns a company, but the company still competes. So if you think about things like the very, very large Chinese state-owned companies, they are competitive with other companies across the world, but they're still owned by the government. The key to it is that process of competition that is driving, in turn, this need for accumulation, so the endless kind of need to grab more and more wealth and to throw that back into the process of competition and to keep doing this as a cycle. And what that means is that capitalism, unlike any other way of organizing the economy, of organizing society that we've ever seen in human history, has this incredible dynamic. There was progress before capitalism. Things did change. Inventions did happen. Societies did alter gradually how they did things. You know, the water wheel was invented, milling was invented, go back far enough, writing was invented, these things happened. What you get into capitalism is a sort of institutionalization of that process. So it's always dynamic, always has to do new things because of this process of competitive accumulation. All the different bits of capitalism are competing against one another to try and accumulate, and that gives it a dynamic. And what that means is that if you say you have to stop, unlike any other previous economic system, this is pretty well catastrophic for it. It's kind of impossible, or at least very, very difficult for the thing to stop. Because if you're saying to people, don't go out to work because you'll spread this terrible virus, you're saying that you can't go out to work, you can't produce the wealth that's part of what capitalism does. You can't necessarily go and buy the things that capitalism produces because you can't go to the shops. And so the whole thing seizes up. If you've got an entire system that's geared towards always having growth, always producing more and more accumulation and competition, and all of this very, very dynamic process, and you're saying, well, now we have to stop, it's an enormous crisis. It's a far bigger economic crisis than any of us have seen in our lifetimes, and really anybody's seen for several generations.
What would happen to the global economy if, say, the state didn't intervene in circumstances like this? Could you just set out and describe what that would look like?
Well, that gets very complicated. We almost had a trial run of what it looks like if the government does nothing, because we had a government in this country that was committed to a strategy of doing nothing. They called it herd immunity.
In terms of building up a herd immunity within the UK, what sort of percentage of people need to have contracted the virus?
Probably about 60%.
Working assumption was that if you get 60 to 80% of the population has the virus, we'll all build up a collective immunity, and a few people, often older people, would die, but basically everybody could more or less carry on as they were. And your way of dealing with that is perhaps also to then try and sort of socially isolate just the older people and this sort of thing. When it turned out over the last week or so that modelling for this showed that 250,000 people would die, that's the kind of glimpse of what happens if you do nothing about this. The issue with the COVID-19 virus is that it is very, very infectious relative to other similarly sort of deadly diseases we've seen in the past. It's more infectious, it would seem, than the SARS outbreak of 2003. And it has a long period of time, a long latency period, where you can have it and you won't necessarily have any symptoms or be aware that you have it, and it's still infectious. So you've got maybe a week, 14 days, where you can be spreading this. And it ends up, it was seen mostly in terms of the very bad consequences of it, including a large number of people dying. This is nearly all older people and people with underlying conditions. So it is actually quite deadly for a particular set of the population. So it's not designed. This is a mutation in the virus that gets us here, but it's kind of well integrated into spreading rapidly amongst a human population organised like the one we have, and that's what's happened. So if you do nothing, a large number of people die. That's what all the public health officials would tell us. If every economy in the world decided to do nothing, a large number of people die, I think you'd be looking at breakdown of social order and that sort of thing. I don't think a country like Britain could cope with 250,000 people dying in the space of a few months. I think this would be an immense and catastrophic crisis, quite apart from the human sort of damage and trauma it causes. So what you see happening instead is governments have intervened more or less rapidly against the virus, because they have to, because the sort of basics of holding a society together are at risk here. So they have to intervene. Most likely, as we look over the next few months, as gradually this wave of the virus dies off, as immunity builds up and the number of people who have it who are infected with it reduces as people recover, and what you're looking at is most likely those governments moved quickest on this and took immediate steps to try and curtail the spread of the virus are going to be the ones that recover fastest and potentially have a sort of permanent advantage, economically speaking, in the near future. So in that case, you're looking at China, South Korea, Taiwan, other places that spring to mind as countries that intervene very rapidly against the virus, whereas Britain and the US have been extremely slow in moving on this, and that's going to have long-term economic consequences.
Can I stick for a second on capitalism and just ask, if capitalism runs a skeleton system, which I think is part of the point, isn't it? If you kind of maintain everybody's wages and everybody can keep buying stuff, but they just can't interact or socialise or produce themselves, and you're running at this kind of very pared down system, will that kind of keep it on life support or not?
It's like capitalism on rations for a bit, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, does it just endure intense capitalist weight loss, or does it actually starve to death?
Well, we don't quite know yet because we haven't tried it, and we'll see where we get to. It should in theory be possible to sort of preserve the core functions of the economy. So, you keep the lights on, you keep gas, water, and frankly broadband all running at this point in time. You keep the hospitals open and supplied. You make sure there's food delivered and not on the shelves. So you keep all of that going. Everything else has to go in something like hibernation. I mean, that's metaphorically what we're all trying to achieve at the minute for the next sort of few months, because that's the way to get on top of the virus and come out the other side with hopefully a minimum number of people suffering and dying. I mean, that's the blunt facts of the situation. Can capitalism survive like that for a long period of time? Well, it can do, you suspect, but it would end up in a very different place. You'd end up with a capitalism where the state is intervening in a very, very large way to try and make sure people are only interacting under certain circumstances. You can see this already with the issue of key workers can still send their children to school, everybody else can't. So that's already quite a big intervention that's taken place there. The government has stepped in, and I suppose we'll come on to this, to say that, for an employee who's been laid off, we'll cover 80% of your wages up to £2,500. So it's a huge state intervention. It can't maintain it indefinitely, because the implication here is very, very significant sums are being borrowed. In other words, it's relying on the fact there will be some recovery in the future to try and repay those sums that are now going to be used to pay everyone to not go to work effectively. So you end up with a very, very peculiar new version of capitalism, and frankly, one that's going to be very hard to avoid significant long-term consequences out of it of all sorts of different kinds. I mean, one of the obvious ones is simply that once you introduce a policy, it becomes quite sticky. The council tax was introduced 28 years ago in this country. It was supposed to be a temporary measure. It's still there 28 years later. So a lot of the things the government's now putting in place are likely to still stick in place afterwards and going to be quite hard to wind back in.
To what extent do you think this is a huge shift in Conservative Party ideology? Because it seems like a very odd situation to have economists on the right and the left both seem to be united around this idea that huge intervention is necessary. This is the Conservative Party of Margaret Thatcher, for goodness sake.
Let us never forget this fundamental truth. The state has no source of money other than the money people earn themselves. There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayers' money.
Now it's in this situation where it has this sweeping intervention into the economy. Do you think that this is going to change the nature of Toryism? If you look at Johnson's message in the general election, for example, it wasn't traditional Thatcherism. It was much more, we're going to bring the whole country together. We're going to have an infrastructure revolution. I never agreed with austerity anyway. That was David Cameron's idea. I'm an investment politician and all this kind of stuff. But this seems to turbocharge those changes that were already there.
I think so. That's one way to look at it. I think for now, we're in a world of sort of pragmatism, that there is just a need because there is a very, very significant cost to not doing anything. So there's just a need for the government to do something. And they're being dragged slowly towards a position that's useful from a public health point of view. I mean, it has to be said, these, 7 weeks is a suggestion put about, is the period over which they could have been preparing, that it was known that this was a very serious, very aggressive pandemic or potential pandemic at the time. It was perfectly clear from what was happening in Wuhan in China that this would spread rapidly and overwhelm health systems. And the government basically did nothing in the belief that, you know, they could follow a strategy of herd immunity and everything would stay the same. So that's clearly now not going to be the case. And also, incidentally, that delay will have killed people. That delay means more people will die, already dying, and will die over the next few weeks because nothing was done beforehand. So they're having to slowly sort of try and catch up with the severity of the situation.
I was thinking there's something quite interesting in the way that, I mean, I don't want to pin this on the Conservatives. It might be standard political action, which is reminiscent of the floods. There doesn't seem to be much middle ground between we can't afford anything because we're tightening our belts and just get on with it and preserve the economy, and money is no object. And they seem to have gone immediately from that, from the first place to the second place. And I wonder if that's like a necessary and natural political pendulum.
It is under these circumstances, because the issue with the virus is it sort of attacks the central bit of capitalism, which is the labour market. It's the central institution of capitalism, is the relationship between capital and the people who own the capital, the people who own the wealth, the machinery, the equipment, and the people who have to work for a living. And what this virus does is sort of, it sticks itself in the middle of this and radically reduces your supply of labour. It distorts how the labour market is going to operate. So it's really fundamental to how capitalism functions, and therefore requires an absolutely fundamental intervention, of which Rishi Sunak, I mean, this is a former Goldman Sachs banker, and I think someone who up until this point has never noted for his belief in having big government. He suddenly turns around and says, right, you know, we're covering 80% of wages for those people laid off who are employed. It's still not quite enough, because it's still excluding, as of now, the self-employed, for example, from most of that coverage and most of that protection. So there's still sort of steps gradually down the line that they're trying to make here. The bit that might start to concern us is what happens in 3-4 months' time, let's say, if this thing has died down a bit. And already you can see, you know, CapEx, the sort of very libertarian right-wing, hard-right free market website editorial this morning saying, well, look, you know, we're going to have a big debt. That means at the end of all this, we're going to have to wind everything back in and impose austerity, and we're going to have to shrink the state. So a lot of those arguments could turn up again. Now, my own feeling is that the debts that the government is going to run up over this period of time are going to be so astronomical. And at the same time, the case for having a well-prepared public sector, in other words, one that you haven't cut to the bone due to austerity, because part of the reason it's going to be so serious in this country is because we've whittled away at every bit of the public sector for the last 10 years, including the NHS, but also social care, public health spending, all of these things have been squashed. because we aren't prepared, it's going to be worse here. So I would have thought coming out of this, there may well be an argument for some of the Tory side of things to say, and now is the time to cut back because of all these debts. But when you're running up against an argument where you've just demonstrated in practice how essential public spending is, that's going to be a very, very weak placement to argue from. So we may well see a longer term shift in Conservative ideology, which, like Luke said, I think was already in train around the election and been building up for the last few years, really since Brexit and Theresa May taking over as Prime Minister.
My anxiety is that if you look back to the financial crash, a lot of us have been complaining about the shadow financial system for a long time. And then we were really gleeful when it crashed because we were like, oh, they didn't listen to us. But look, they've blown themselves up. And then the recovery from it utilised none of those solutions that critiqued the system as it was in the first place and just hit a load of people who weren't anything to do with it for a decade. And I suppose the anxiety of that replicated would be, we think we go into the post-corona era saying, look, you've proven what government intervention can be, and you've proven that it's moral, and you've proven that it's worth it. So why can't we live like that in the future? But actually, we'll need to put something kind of more solid in place in order for there not to be a kind of austerity mark two afterwards to recover from it.
Yes, exactly. And I think you can see the Conservative argument being lined up already, and they are lining up already, and it's a good argument for them because it gets the government off the hook, which is to say, oh, well, the reason all this is happening, because you idiots out there are all still going to the pub, you're all still going to work, you're all still on the tube.
Why, in your view, are people ignoring the advice?
Well, I don't know. Because it's very selfish.
The reality of this is that if you don't pay people so they don't have to go to work, they will have to go to work, particularly if they're self-employed or on a temporary contract or anything like this. And if you don't give people clear instructions about what to do, and frankly, the government has not given clear instructions about what to do, then it's hard for people to take seriously what you're saying to them. And it's also hard for them to work out what it is they should be doing. Oh, you're advised not to go to the pub. Well, does that mean you should go to the pub or you shouldn't go to the pub? How serious is it if I go to the pub? And I still have to work and things are sort of ticking along normally. So should I take any of this seriously? You know, they've failed a basic public health communications thing in addition to failing to put in place the protections needed to actually make social distancing work on a mass scale, which means everybody stays in their homes, basically. And they're lining up an argument about it's the public's fault, it's your personal responsibility, the reason it was so bad here is because these terrible people all trooping off to the pub or doing whatever terrible thing it is that they're doing. It's a way of shifting the blame back onto the individual. So it's a mutation in the sort of Conservative Party ideology there. The state is still incapable, or at best it sort of turns up at the last minute, but really it's everybody's fault for being such terrible people and not listening to what the grown-ups were telling them, that kind of thing. Ignoring the fact that the grown-ups, you know, the government sat on its hands for what, 6 weeks or so before deciding to actually try and take this seriously. So you can see where the ideological argument is going to end up, where it's going to be over the next few weeks and where it's going to end up coming out the crisis the other side, I think. Up until about maybe a week ago, they were saying, oh, well, it is all sort of behavioural economics. It's the nudge unit thinking. We're going to carefully deal with the fact that we don't expect people to listen to our advice. I mean, that's what the thing was premised around. The issue of herd immunity was that you can't tell people to go into lockdown because they'll get fatigued and just give up on it. So in other words, people aren't going to listen to your advice. And now they're turning around and saying, oh, this is terrible that people aren't listening to our advice. Well, up until a week ago, everything they were doing, if they had an excuse for it, was based around the idea that people weren't going to listen to the advice. It's a very cynical way of operating here, which is to cover up for essentially trying to get to what looks like the lowest short-term cost option available, which is not to use the state to do anything and just sit there and say herd immunity will carry us through. And there is a competitive logic there, potentially, which is that, look, the countries that have already gone into lockdown have taken huge economic hits. If you look at GDP in China, it has dropped a huge amount, 9-10%, something like this over the last quarter or so. Same thing in Korea, same thing in Taiwan. That's already there as a big economic hit. So if you think, okay, we've got a cheap option of not doing this, and maybe we have a bit of a knock to GDP, but we don't have to do that, then you might think that that would put you in a better position somewhere down the line. The problem, of course, is that you actually overwhelm society, the NHS, the trauma of so many people dying so rapidly, that sort of thing. It's just completely unsustainable. So now you have to try and put in place the lockdown, but you're doing it at the worst possible point. You're doing it a long way into the notorious curve of the virus spreading, and you're doing it at a point where you're not going to make that much difference to how far it spreads by now. So the costs are high all over the place. So it's a complete mess. I mean, it's a catastrophic failure of government in the last few weeks that we're now being given an excuse of, well, the public are ignorant and terrible and they're all going to the park or going to the pub or carry on going to work, even though for weeks and weeks they've been told it's all okay, just carry on pretty much as you are, but sing happy birthday when you're washing your hands. It's pathetic.
So is there an argument that tactically we should be really not finger pointing? We shouldn't engage with the finger pointing. We should shut down the finger pointing.
Yes, the fundamental function of government is to basically protect the public. You know, it's to sort of provide some minimal level of public security. The point at which government is contemplating a course of action which will kill 250,000 people is a point at which they have catastrophically failed in the elementary duties of what a government is doing. It is their fault. It is not anybody else's fault. Yes, you as an individual should probably not be trooping around a place and hugging all your friends and neighbours and going to the pub and whatever else. True. But if we take all of us as a collective, given the mixed messages that government has sent and given the sort of things they've been trying to tell us for the last sort of 6 weeks or so now, up until really last weekend, and the fact they still, by the way, aren't putting in place the measures you need to make sure people really are socially isolating, like giving money to the self-employed so they can stay at home, that kind of thing. So given all these mixed messages, it is the government's fault. They have failed on this. They have failed catastrophically and they're looking a way out of this. And actually just expressing the truth of the situation, I don't think we should be going around pointing the fingers too much at people who are still going to the pub or whatever. I think on an individual basis, of course, you shouldn't be doing this. But if you take what's happened to society as a whole and the responsibilities that government has to society, it's the government that's failed on this.
I do think the generational sides of this are really interesting, particularly when you consider how grey the Conservative vote is now. The most accurate, probably, description of how the UK government got to this stage is probably incompetence rather than conspiracy. Because if you look at the generational impacts of it in the context of what happened in the 2019 general election, it's very interesting because, on the one hand, the Tory vote is overwhelmingly among the group in society, the elderly, who will be hit by the impact of COVID-19 more than anyone else. Yet on the other side, the labour market effects are overwhelmingly borne by those in work. So there's like a big disparity between, if you like, the health victims, potentially, or what we think anyway, of COVID-19 will be, and the workplace reality of what's happening too.
I agree with that, although if you look at the polling as things stand, and I do think this will shift as the scale of what's taking place and the level of responsibility for the government becomes apparent over the next few weeks. But if you look at the polling, you find that it is the sort of older group of people, 65 plus, who are most supportive of what the government's doing, and at the same time, most believing that there's, you know, this is just like flu, this is just something that will pass and all that, which I do find quite striking. It's quite striking that there is a larger set of often older people who are least receptive of sort of public health messages around this. And there's probably all sorts of things going on there. So genuinely, for this country, you strongly suspect, and this applies to all of us, it's not somewhere where anything really disastrous on a massive society-wide level has happened for a very long time. Really not since the Second World War. We haven't had anything, any experience that actually in other parts of the world, you do have epidemic outbreaks, you do have famines or wars or whatever. This hasn't happened here. So for generations, everything bad has looked like it's somewhere else. And you end up with quite a well-entrenched belief that this is kind of how the world is. And I do wonder if some of that has informed, you know, how everybody's been thinking about this for rather too long. We should have been taking this seriously and we weren't. And the principal failure there is the government.
Just sticking on government policy for a second, they went from inaction to an announcement. It was very like Denmark's, actually, that they would cover 80%. They reached very quick terms with the TUC. They did a kind of traditional social democratic model of public support. But are there countries doing things very differently to either us or Denmark that we should be aware of?
There's lots of people doing variants of a sort of universal basic income, or at least some cash handouts. Ireland has it's not particularly generous, but it's not a bad scheme. That's, what, €208 a week for everybody who's out of work, and that's payable to across the population. Hong Kong, I think, awards everyone 10,000 Hong Kong dollars. That's about, you know, £1,500, maybe a bit less. Australia doing something similar. It's even been talked about in the US. I mean, Mitt Romney was proposing a sort of universal cash handouts. And that does look like the best and fairest and quickest way just to try and get everybody to the point where they're not having to, you know, they're not having to worry about their own security and therefore they don't have to go out of work. And the other side of that, I suppose, is the fact that some places, Denmark, Norway, amongst them, are protecting those who rent in addition to those who have mortgages. At the moment in this country, you're looking at a 3-month mortgage holiday, which is good if you have a mortgage and now, you know, you can take that money away. It's not so good if you rent. Obviously, you're still, you know, having to pay the thing, and the fact you won't get evicted for a month or whatever it is doesn't remove the fact that this is now a debt that's building up that will be due when the crisis passes. So there's clearly more work needs to be done there by this government, and there are good examples in the rest of the world. I mean, what was striking about how quickly they moved, I suppose, was potentially that you're looking here at when you start to restrict the labour supply because you have to. That's what this thing does economically. It's, you know, you have to have people working less one way or the other, or certainly working differently, but a lot of people, it just means working less. Once you restrict the labour supply like this, then potentially labour suddenly has a bit more bargaining power. And I do wonder if this sudden, you know, the government agreeing to the TEC demands very, very rapidly isn't the first glimmerings of something like that taking place in the future, where the big shift over the last 40 years or so, which was against labour and against people who work, the balance of power in workplaces shifted decisively in favour of employers and against the people who have to work for a wage. You wonder if that perhaps one side effect of this is starting to shift that balance back again, that if we're going to be living in a world coming out the other side of this, in which pandemics are a recurring feature, epidemics are a recurring feature, and the risks are now priced into everybody's actions, then potentially Labour's in a stronger position than it was perhaps over the last sort of 4 decades or so.
They've got to do something for the self-employed, right? Presumably that announcement is coming, and it presumably will take a universal form because of the difficulties of means testing the self-employed in terms of their income now and not their income last financial year in the context of COVID-19 crisis where incomes just collapse.
You'd think so. I mean, with Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, in fact, I think he was governor of the Bank of England during the 2008-09 crisis, coming out and saying something has to be done in this year. I think you can see the pressure building up on the government to have to move on this. Now, why it wasn't possible if they're going to move to do this last week and remove some of the uncertainty, and frankly, to remove the fact that people are still going out to work, and therefore this is still a public health issue if they move on this. Why it was not possible to do it last week is not clear. What they do, it might vary a bit. A universal income of some form is probably the quickest and easiest way to do it. In Norway, they've offered similar protection to if you're employed, which is up to 80% of your earnings, taking earnings as the average of the last 3 years, because obviously if you're self-employed, you'll have tax returns going back that far. So there might be ways to get around this, and using HMRC is probably the best vehicle to try and get money to people quickly under these circumstances. But they do need to do something. It's an absolutely gaping hole in their entire sort of public health setup now, which is that over 5 million people really don't have adequate protection for themselves.
Well, you're a supporter of universal basic income, right? But what are the other demands that you think we should be mentioning and talking about as a response to the crisis?
Well, I think UBI is a very good starting place. I think the idea of not just a mortgage holiday, but a rent holiday, and not just a holiday, you need to find some way of not having this turn into debt that is going to be due somewhere down the line. I mean, there are other things that are more obvious, actually, which is that this whole business of not having enough ventilators, this is the one where there's a real sort of almost criminal level of negligence by the government. They knew for weeks that Britain has a very, very limited number of ventilators. They knew for weeks that ventilators were an essential for people going into hospital, going to intensive care with the sort of worst form of the virus. That, you know, if you don't get ventilation and you're in that stage, you are very, very likely to die. And they haven't provided this, and they haven't got manufacturers doing this. So the obvious demand is, look, get the manufacturers to do this as rapidly as possible, whether that involves public ownership or it involves just giving them a load of money, taking over in some other form, whatever it needs, you start to do that. So there are some demands around that. I think also, I mean, you can see that the polling actually on rationing of food and making sure everybody has a fair supply of food, it's actually a very popular policy. The YouGov poll says about 63% of the public would support this. And I think as the damage that this is doing to supply chains becomes more apparent, and I do think what we're seeing, if you see empty shelves in supermarkets, is not so much panic buying. If you look at takings by supermarkets, they're up a bit, but they're not up enough to reflect mass panic buying. What you're looking at there is very, very fragile supply chains that only need a very small knock to start immediately causing problems down the line, and suddenly the shelves start to go empty. If people remember that business with Kentucky Fried Chicken running out of chicken for a week because there was a crash outside a warehouse in Rugby, and it's entire distribution network in the country is knocked out for a week. Now, imagine that situation reproduced everywhere, and you can start to see the problems of supply you've got. So I think there's a need, pretty rapidly we'll be hitting this, for government to intervene to secure food supplies and to do that in the fairest way possible. And at that point, you're starting to talk about rationing and this sort of thing. Somewhere down the line, there will probably be a need to talk about writing off debt. I would have thought there's a very good place to say that debts incurred during this pandemic should not be debts that need to be honoured. And I think that'll be a reasonable demand to place in 3, 4, 5 months' time, when hopefully this all subsides.
Luke, I notice you on Twitter today were excited about rail nationalisation, or, you know, in a academic way, not in a hysterical way. But you seem to be orienting towards this creating very fertile territory for the left. And A, is that right? And B, James, do you agree?
Yeah, I think rail nationalisation is back, and it's similar to the situation in the airline sector too, right, which links to what James said a moment ago about if pandemics are normal, then capitalism now needs to price in the potential risk of investment from pandemics. And that raises huge questions, as has been exposed in this crisis, about the viability of parts of our heavily capital-intensive infrastructure, like railways and airline sector. So there's a kind of pragmatic case for bringing them back into the public sector, I think, even if you're someone who's coming from it as how do we save capitalism, not how do we end capitalism.
The IPPR and Commonwealth, two of the think tanks here in London, have produced a good short paper on what needs to happen to the airline industry if we're talking about bringing all or part of it into public ownership. And obviously a major part of what needs to happen to the airline industry is, first, you want to protect jobs there, but second, you want to make sure there's a just transition out of flying so much, and that will mean shrinking the size of the airline industry. One of the questions here, and it's slightly unknowable, but I think we are going to end up in a world where the costs of future pandemics are priced in. If you think what happened after 2008 and 9, we didn't do as much as we needed to, but there were extra controls put in place in what finance does. The macroprudential regulation is called. The idea that having seen one kind of systemic crisis, we wanted to take action to prevent it happening in the future. And this has imposed costs on how finance behaves. It has more regulations now than it used to, so it's a cost. If we've seen one global pandemic, then we want to avoid that in the future. That will impose costs on business of one form or another. And it may well be, you know, there'll be less international travel, certainly for business meetings and things like this. So there's a kind of cost that starts to build in there. And I think you're absolutely right to say that will shift the appeal of some forms of investment, airlines being an obvious one, perhaps transport in general being another, you know, holiday making, this sort of thing all might start to look rather different. And that's a question of how much the future risk of pandemics starts to get priced in. I mean, don't forget that the number of epidemics and pandemics is increasing because of the pressure we're putting on the planet in one form or another, of urbanisation, of intensive farming in particular. Climate change is linked to a rising number of epidemics and pandemics globally. So we can expect most of these things to recur in the future. And potentially, of course, you know, coronavirus itself becoming endemic in a human population. So you can expect kind of flare-ups of this. Looking from this point onwards, this does already get talked about. It was one of the excuses the government's used for herd immunity was the need to avoid a second or a third wave of this same virus at some point in the future. So once all that is there, the world has to start to look quite different. It's not going to be the world of globalization in the form that we've got used to it, of a great deal of international travel and international trade, for instance. It looks really quite different and much more regulated as a result.
And you've got, I guess, to plug it to listeners, you've got a piece in the New Statesman on this today or yesterday, talking about what this means for globalization. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, because you were sort of speculating about the kinds of capitalism that might emerge. So capitalism is going through this process where it's becoming slightly less global over the last decade since the financial crisis. There's been less flows of finance, you pointed out, across borders. So tell us a bit about that.
This is something that's the last 10 years since the financial crisis. If you take the sort of 30 years up until 2008, you basically, the world economy grows and world trade grows faster than the world economy. So more of what we produce is being traded across borders. And then world financial flows, cross-border financial flows grow even faster than that. So this is the, you know, the classic image of what does globalization look like. It's, you know, you flick a switch in New York and you transfer £1 billion from Tokyo to the UK or whatever. And that's the sort of classic image of globalization. It's what we think globalization is. And for 30 years, it looks like this. The world becomes more and more globalized in this way and then hits the buffers in 2008, 2009, more than buffers really, it's a crash. Since that period of time, this is unwound. So the economy has grown somewhat, but trade has not grown as much as the global economy has. So in other words, less of what we produce is now being traded across international borders. And financial flows are down hugely. Cross-border financial flows are down about 65% as of 2017. These are the McKinsey Global Institute estimates. So that's an enormous shrinking of financial flows and that kind of classic thing of globalization, which is heavily financialized, dependent on what finance does. So we're already, before this crisis, this coronavirus hit, we were already in quite a different world to, you know, the preceding 30 years or so. The direction, the line of travel was different. And part of that involved a lot more state intervention in the economy. And what we've seen in the pandemic is that's been, the volume's been turned up in that in a spectacular way. Almost certainly coming out of this the other side, we're not going to suddenly get back to never mind the sort of pre-2007 version of globalization. I think that's just dead and finished. I don't think we'll even get back to a pre-coronavirus version of semi-globalization. I think we're going to have permanently more state intervention, permanently more, for instance, monitoring of populations for signs of the virus and flagging where people go, and this sort of fairly intensive surveillance built into the thing. There's the potential for conflict there, a real conflict over privacy and control of people's lives and what it means to have a decent functioning democratic society under conditions where there is a sort of permanent perceived pandemic risk. So that does shift things, and that does change how capitalism operates. It's no longer neoliberal capitalism in the sense we usually think about it, where it's the free market and private corporations do whatever they want. It's suddenly a kind of state capitalism. The government's heavily involved in everything, and the conflicts that we have, a lot of them are about control of data and the activities of monitoring and surveillance and the rest of it.
When we talk about corporations and business now, there just seems to be so much a difference between different companies. So, you know, for the great bulk of corporations, as I understand it, they're heavily in debt. They've grown fat off quantitative easing indirectly over the last decade, but they're not doing particularly well. But then you have a handful of corporations that just have vast amounts of cash. And that means that's going to be a factor going forward as well, this kind of dominance of a handful of incredibly wealthy corporations over the rest.
Yes, I think that's a key factor of it. I mean, there's two parts to that. One of them is exactly as you say, for great chunks of the corporate sector, it's loaded up with debt over the last 10 years or so. Household debt has risen, not so much in the, what do you call it, the advanced economies, as we used to call them, like the OECD members, but more in the places like China and the sort of less developed countries where you see a big increase in household debt. But for the advanced economies, it has been an increase in corporate debt that's been very striking, except for exactly as you say, those companies, well, in fact, everyone's been trying to build up cash piles, but the companies that have done it spectacularly are big tech companies. So, you know, Apple sitting on an enormous, basically, pile of cash. Same goes for Microsoft, Google, all of that set. And that puts me in a very, very good position to weather this particular storm, to be quite honest, because if everybody else has massive amounts of debt and the economy's crashed in a huge way, I mean, Goldman Sachs projections for the second quarter in the US is that the US economy will shrink by 30%. Now, this is bigger than the Great Depression. This is like Russia in 1991 sort of scale of economic disintegration. That's the sort of thing you're talking about there. So if you're a corporation with loads and loads of debt and the economy's just crashed, suddenly your debt becomes even more unpayable because all your markets are disappearing in front of you. So you're really, really in a bad place. If you're a company that's facing that situation with vast amounts of cash, you're much more secure. So you can kind of ride that out much more happily than anybody else can do. And you probably won't need, you know, state support in quite the same way as large number of corporations will. The other part of that is the reason the tech companies have built up this immense market power is basically the sort of raw economics of how data operates. It's got these incredible economies of scale. If you have one data set, if you can combine that with another data set, so you collected data of somebody using your site on the internet, whatever it might be, Facebook or Twitter or something, you combine that with another data set, you can use very, very fast computers to analyze those two data sets, derive all sorts of interesting results, model all kinds of consumer behavior and all kinds of things that are worth a great deal of money out of it. And the more data sets you can get, the richer you can become out of the side of it. So this is the economy of scale here. And the result of that is you end up with very, very large tech companies completely dominating their particular sections of the market. And the impact of this particular crisis is likely to be only to accelerate that domination over the next period of time.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can access new material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members help keep the show on the road, even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, I asked James how opposition parties can balance being responsible on the one hand and scrutinising the government winning demands from opposition in this time of crisis on the other. You can also help us reach new listeners by leaving a rating or review on your podcast platform. What remarkable times we're in. To learn more about the ideas discussed on today's pod, check out the links to a reading in the description you can find on your podcast platform. We'll be back very soon. See you then, and look after each other.